Hello and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast, the show that helps parents move from feeling overwhelmed to feeling empowered. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, IEP coach, educational therapist, and executive director of Learning Essentials. With over 25 plus years in the field, I have walked alongside hundreds of families as they've navigated the special education process, and I know just how isolating and confusing it can feel, but here, you're not alone. Today, we're diving into a topic that so many families struggle with. How to take medical findings like those long neuropsychological evaluations, audiology reports, neurological diagnosis, and actually bridge them into meaningful support at school. I couldn't think of a better person to guide us than Dr. Jennifer Reisman. Dr. Reisman is a clinical neuropsychologist, board certified in both clinical and pediatric neuropsychology, director of neuropsychology at Chesapeake ADHD Center. Her expertise lies in helping families understand complex medical information and turn it into everyday strategy and educational plans that work. Whether your kiddo has just had their first evaluation or you're trying to make sense of conflicting recommendations, this conversation is about giving you tools, confidence, and hope as you advocate for your kiddo. Hello and welcome. Thank you, Dr. Reisman, for joining us today. I'm excited to talk and get to know what you're doing a little bit better. And so before we start our conversation, give me just a little bit of insight, folks that are listening, about who you are and what you love to do.
Yeah. So my name is Jen Reisman. I'm a pediatric neuropsychologist here in Bethesda, Maryland at the Chesapeake Center. And I love working with children all the way up through adults. And some of my special interest is in working with children with chronic health conditions, with disabilities, and specifically those who are deaf or hard of hearing.
Which makes you unique in that sense in terms of being able to assess children and connecting with families because that you have that phenomenal skill set on your side.
And I also say that it's given me a unique perspective on things like access and language and culture and communication, which really colors a lot of my view on things. So I realize that some of our discussion today may be heavy on the access and communication parts.
Yes, please definitely add that in anywhere you see fit. That would be fabulous. Before we hop in, I'd love to ask my guests, what is something that is little known about you or what you do, not necessarily with your work, but maybe it's a hobby, an interest, a sport, an activity, something that doesn't necessarily go along, or maybe it does go along with what you're doing now?
Ooh, so hobbies and activities are definitely going to be my best furry companion, my dog. And right, but it's also given me a lovely, healthy perspective on how much we may think we know one thing about training or support. And no, we don't, but dogs are also just the best. And so I am so happy that I've had a dog in my life since 2021. I didn't used to until I started moving my practice actually here locally to Montgomery County and ditched having a really long commute.
Do you bring your puppy dog to work?
I wish I could, but I'm very interested in those who train facility dogs and therapy dogs. And that's something that I hope in the future I might be able to do in my personal life.
Yes. So, and I know we've just gotten off topic, but I will say my middle son, also in Montgomery County here, his teacher in middle school brought a dog to school. She trained them for vets. And so they were service dogs, but my son loved it. He could go into his teacher's office and the dog, you know, she'd let him have special pets with him. The dog went with her everywhere around the school. The principal submitted a letter every year just saying, hey, we have this dog in our building. This is the purpose of the dog. So it was really kind of cool.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So it was super neat. Super neat. All right. So kind of back in what we're talking about, I want to kind of just set the stage and talk about early signs at home, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of parents may notice little things at home. Maybe their kiddo is kind of missing directions or struggling with routines or meltdowns after school. From your perspective, what are some of those early signs families should get curious about, pay attention to, and just kind of think, gives you, you know, as a mama of three, but just as a parent in general, you always worry about your baby. So what are some things that parents should just start to kind of think about as they see?
Yeah, I think the big thing, and this is something I emphasize a lot in conversation with families, is when is something getting in the way of your child's every day? Because we all know that our kids can have a variety of personality styles, brain styles, a kind of way of approaching the world. And those children who may need a little bit more support or preparation, but are able to go and do the things that they want to do and also that they need to do, right? Like as parents, we know that there's the stuff that you want your child to do, but there's the stuff that they also need to do. And when you find that more of these things that you're noticing as a parent are interfering with the need to do's, I think those are the ones to really pay attention to and talk with primary care, talk with trusted friend, or think about reaching out to a specialist if there's something that's needed to take a closer look at, because those are the things that I think parents are some of the first to notice. And it's all too common I hear in my office when parents say, "Oh, I noticed this way back when." And they probably have an example of like early toddlerhood.
And speaking of toddlerhood, at kind of that age and stage in your training and what you do kind of then aligns with what if a parent does bring this to a pediatrician or something and it's like, oh, it's within realm. But then as a parent, you're kind of then thinking like, something like my gut is telling me this is different. Like, when is that time and when do we like kind of listen to that little knock, so to say, and when do we are just like, all right, I'm going to shelf this for a little bit.
Yeah, I think this is also when having a journal or having some sense of that is very important because, right, there can be the let's keep an eye on that and see if that indeed changes over the next 3 months, for example, because parents are sometimes great at noticing the correlation with environmental changes, and that many times other professionals, pediatricians, right? Pediatricians are fantastic at reassuring because they see such a large percentage of children and know that sometimes these things are not a challenge. But then parents of children who do indeed have learning differences or a disorder that requires attention sometimes feel like they were put off or that they missed out on time for intervention because they may have been told to wait and see a little bit. So I think it's important to actually have kind of some of these times where, when did I first notice something? What was the first advice? And then checking back and kind of going back to this, because when you say, okay, we've given this child a period of months to adjust to this change in the environment, whether it's a new caregiver, whether it's a new school, a new teacher, or something like that, this isn't it. There's something else that we do need to pay attention to. I think those are all valid concerns, but sometimes that first line of, oh, just wait and see, this is within the realm of normal. When we see that that's persisted on beyond a time, it can be very hard when you get wrapped up in the day-to-day, right? To notice that, just like all of a sudden you turn around and unless you do the little yearly marks on the doorway, you don't recognize that your child's grown until you realize, oh my gosh, their pants are way up to their knees now and we need new pants. Similar to some behavior and emotional challenges too.
I think it's important for families to kind of track, as we're saying, and that can seem overwhelming for a parent. So I even just through IEP coaching and supporting families have those conversations of kind of track down what you see. What does homework time look like? What does this time look like? What do transitions look like? Have you come across any great suggestions to make that tracking easier for a parent so that they can share with professional, regardless if it's inside the school building or outside the school day?
Yeah, I've definitely had parents give me different strategies. And one of the ones that I appreciate was a favorite of mine that I heard from a parent was she said, I would just send an email to myself. And that way she would put the subject line like as her child or as the concern. And then she could go back through her email and knew that she sent it. And I thought that was really brilliant because when we think about like cognitively what we do with an email is we send it and kind of forget it sometimes. And it's nice because unlike, filling out a paper journal or a chart or something like that, but it's also time linked. And I appreciated that so much because that way this parent could go back and see, I sent myself weekly emails and then it turned out they were all on Fridays. And I could see that my child was really exhausted by the end of the week. And, then it made a recommendation shift about a change in schedule and how we could better support that child. But I would have had no way of knowing that if this parent hadn't actually been able to time and date link that and really set that up for me. So I thought that's actually one brilliant thing that I've heard from a parent is to kind of email those concerns to yourself when they pop up. Doesn't have to be lengthy, but then at least you know when it was happening.
Yeah, and I actually, that's funny you brought that up because I emailed myself a couple nights ago. I know you're not supposed to have your phone at night, but and I
No.
was like, I didn't have like a sticky or anything. And I was like, I'm just going to email myself. So in the morning I see it. And that is helpful exactly because you have the date and the time stamp if you're kind of curating a list there. What do you say to parents that come to you, kind of back to that original of their the wait and see, and you know, and I've spoken to parents that kind of really sometimes sadly beat themselves up, so to say, that oh, I should have done this sooner. What are some kind of words of wisdom that they're in the right place at the right time for what they're needing?
Oh, I am so happy you asked this because I think this is something where alleviating a lot of guilt is an important part of how I feel I need to work with families because guilt helps us in no way, shape, or form. And that especially if you're, getting to either a specialist evaluation or a specialist treatment, that the most important time is that time that you're there now and you can only move forward. And that we can really do the best job we have with where we're at now. And part of that is understanding where we've come. And so understanding the past, understanding what the timeline was up there, but that from that moment forward, the goal should be to change that trajectory of that child's life, that we're going to put in place things that will make things a better and easier, less friction-filled trajectory is really the goal. And that's the only way we can move. And I have not found the time travel hack. So I have not found a way to go back and even as a parent, like to put back in the words in my mouth that I regret saying to my own children or to my colleagues or friends or things. I have not found it. And so the best way that we can move forward is now. And also the timing part is huge. I have had families in my office sometimes beating themselves up saying, well, we should really do this evaluation in the spring or the summer. And I just want to alleviate any of that stress because there's no perfect time. I've had families line up, the most beautiful, brilliant time to like get an evaluation or see a specialist, and then their child gets the flu, right? And then they need to reschedule in the next appointment's not for a while out, or you're on vacation. Like life happens. And so when you're there and seeking the care or the evaluation or the specialty services, that's when you're supposed to be there, and that's okay.
Yeah. And what terrific permission to give that grace as parents that are trying to just navigate so much. Once we receive one of your amazing reports, as a parent, it can seem very overwhelming. I say this phrase a lot in terms of just coming from fear and love. And it's just filled with pages and pages, and there's technical words, and there's graphs, and there's recommendations. When a parent first kind of sits down with one of these reports, do you even have a recommendation of like where they should start and even start? And I know they would have a conversation and kind of a debrief, but still it takes some time to really process and think through kind of what my next steps are.
One of the things I have to say, so because Wendy, you've given me this platform, I can also use this opportunity to say, on behalf of all neuropsychologists and psychologists, let me offer all parents an apology. Collectively, our field writes too much, and there's actually been some studies on this. And unfortunately, my field can sometimes be slow in the uptake of those studies, where all the studies actually say those neuropsychology reports are too long. Not everybody reads them, and that the most important things are usually in a few key places. And so let's talk about what those few key places are, but also let me give that apology because the worst thing that's ever happened, and I strive personally for that. And it's also information I strive to communicate to parents because I can think about a phone call I just had not that long ago when a parent actually asked me, they said, Dr. Reisman, if I come in and I see you, how long are your reports typically? And I said, that's a great question. I strive to make sure that my text is not going to go over 10 pages because nobody is going to read beyond that. Then there's tables of data that I have to have so that another psychologist could check my work and see if these numbers make sense and so that we can track patterns of performance over time. But those are just numbers. Those are like your lab test results that you get when you go and you get your blood work drawn. And we really should interpret that within text. And she said, well, but somebody else I talked to said that, like, they write a 20-page report. And she said, in my field, I thought bigger is better. And why wouldn't I want to? And I said, that's a great question. Bigger is only better if it's non-redundant, like not copy-paste, not AI-generated content, and stuff unique to that child. And unfortunately, what I've encountered a lot, and I know you probably have encountered a lot too, is that when we have a teen, you know, carrying around, creating an IEP, lots of documents and everything else like this, bigger is not always better. And that it's extremely important to be a good collaborative team member to be able to narrow down to what the team needs to know to get those kernels of information and insight to be actionable and specific. Because we can all get really overwhelmed with like templated stuff or ways of describing information. Like the Wechsler is a test that does that. I don't do that in my reports because we can talk about that and have a conversation about that, but I don't tend to do that because nobody's going to read it and it's not specific to your child. So anyways, let me apologize. But then what are the key things? I think there's a couple of different places that folks need to look. I will also say, the history section, usually in like psych or neuropsych reports, do a good job of consolidating history that might be relevant, whether it's medical history, educational history. We're great timeline keepers. We really love the like, who done it, where did it happen, and when. Like, when did educational disruption from COVID happen? How long was this child doing virtual school? That's going to be in all my reports. And parents are great experts at that because you lived through it. So you know whether that's accurate or not. So I say it's always good to check and make sure that's accurate. But then the other part is really what I would say is that summary and also our recommendations, because there may be pieces of data that are kind of outliers, and a good psychologist or neuropsychologist should be able to shift out outliers from coherent stuff and insights about your child. And that's what we really want to concentrate on. And then communication of that to people who need to know and can put it, that plan or recommendations into action so that that trajectory, I think about a lot, can be changed for the better moving forward. What I've taken to do in my reports is I have a little section called like key evaluation findings, and I bullet it out because, again, we can get lost in paragraphs. And cognitively, we know this. We can all get lost and overwhelmed in pages and pages and forget what we're reading.
Yeah. Yeah. And so where would you say kind of that first part to look? Like, I know you mentioned labs. So I know if I get my labs, I go in the portal. And I literally just scroll down to look for the red flags.
Yes.
And that's exactly what I do. So where in a report should parents kind of think of it that way, I guess?
Yeah. And that's where I think the most important part, if you don't have someone who's like bulleted out, what are the key findings? Many times it's labeled like a clinical summary, summary and recommendations. I think that's the most important part because we think about that as like the elevator speech about a child. Right? That should be the part where, what does the team need to know about this child moving forward? And then separate from that, probably like the, and sometimes the most important, what is someone thinking that the recommendations are to move forward? Kind of the actionable items. And hopefully those have been prioritized, because I know that some people, there's different schools of thought. Some people will say, I'd rather lay out every single evidence-based recommendation for this child that I can, so it's memorialized in writing. That's one way of doing it. That's kind of like the, you know, the phone book way of doing it or kitchen sink way of doing it. And in other ways can be sometimes the priorities. And so I think it's important to go back and have a follow-up conversation if that wasn't clear or wasn't had, of like, hey doc, what do we think are the top three, right? Because when we think about also just like our human memory capacity, we can only handle so much at one time. And so being able to think about also, what can I communicate to a team about, and also priority, you know, where do we shift our efforts? Where do we, you know, what do we think based on what we've seen, if we've done a pretty big assessment, is going to be the highest priority, highest yield item at this point in time?
I talk about priorities a lot with our families because it can just sheer be just overwhelming, right? Again, you're thinking of your baby, you're thinking how they're going to navigate school and what's going to happen. And, you know, and I always, just for what we do at Learning Essentials and here at the podcast, thinking about school age students, but having that priority and having somebody that can help a parent walk through that is important, to have that other voice to say, all right, here are, this is really what could help now. And then you can always revisit, right?
It's not, doesn't have to be a static. Right? Because what's most important in the transition to, say, elementary to middle school is probably not going to be high on the priority list when we're talking about entering high school, right? Yeah. Like, priorities will shift, your child will shift a lot. And some of the things that seemed so important when they were younger it may become less important as they get a little bit older.
And let me ask a question, right? So if we're talking about kind of taking these evaluations or even audiology reports or just diagnosis and trying to really bridge them with the care and support they're getting in school. But even before that, kind of what are some times, and I know we talked about, you know, let's wait and see, they wonder about that right moment, right? In terms of when should I get my student evaluated, when they're tiny, at a certain age. That's one part. And then I'd like us to kind of also flesh out the difference between a neuropsychologist like yourself and then school testing and the difference between that, so parents can really kind of start to wrap their head around the next steps and taking this information to bridge school and medical.
Yeah. And I think that there's so many confusing things out there about different types of evaluations, especially when I know parents that I've talked to sometimes get the advice from, you know, folks within schools that will say, oh, you don't need an outside evaluation because our school can provide all of the assessment, which may be factually correct, missing some nuance, right? And so again, just because we may use similar tools or some of the same tools may not mean that we same have the same perspective or way of looking at things. And so I think one thing that's important to recognize is that, especially if you're a parent of a child with either special health care needs, additional disabilities that may be cared for outside of school, or additional health-related needs, that school-based evaluations, one just important thing that I often say is that the school may not have access to some of that medical record information. And that's one important thing, that unless you as a parent actively share some of that information, the school will not have that and may not necessarily also seek that out unless it's known to them, right? So I think it's one thing is that it also puts the parent in the burden of making sure that that information is communicated, and that it can be very challenging to know what is the relevant part, right? And I've seen it happen either, you know, children with seizure disorders or additional hearing needs, things like that, where key crucial pieces of information the school may not have had and puts them in a slight disadvantage. If they have all that information, great, they're able to make a lot more sense of it. But their pure goal in those school-based evaluations is in terms of evaluating anything that's getting in the way of access to education and may not have the same appreciation of some of those other medical factors. I will also say that anything that at least I can do in my power, and I think many of my colleagues in neuropsychology, is also to seek to reduce testing burden on a child. So that seeking one type of evaluation doesn't mean that you can't go and get another. And I have a lovely colleague up at Boston Children's Hospital, Molly Colvin, who has really been a big proponent of this, where of empowering families to access school-based evaluations, particularly if they're on a long hospital-based waiting list for services, so that when they come in for a neuropsych evaluation, if they have these additional medical needs, that they may have gotten some testing that's actually going to be very valuable to the neuropsychologist and cut down on their child's appointment length and time and family burden and cost. And I think that those are, you know, kind of fantastic things. Whereas 10, 15 years ago, families were often told or would get two really long, lengthy evaluations and their child would be really exhausted and families would be exhausted. It takes a long time. So I think that it's important to recognize that these educational testing. I've also had families in the position of sometimes not having that request for educational assessment granted. And I know you've worked with family, right? We know that certain times, if certain behaviors or challenges or medical needs are not known to a school, that request may be refused. And that the threshold sometimes for those requests is different. If a child does have certain medical needs where we'd want to establish a baseline, that's where we'd be going and doing an outside assessment. And a school may say, well, we don't have evidence of anything impacting them at school right now, so we don't have the need to really go ahead and do that school-based evaluation. Whereas if we know a child is getting ready to enter treatment for chemotherapy, we want to get a baseline on them to see where we are cognitively. So there may be different nuances on that. I feel like I've hopefully answered that question. And I realize I've been chatting along, going on for a bit about that, Wendy.
No, I love it. And it's perfect. And I think just as a reminder, in terms of that access to education for families, you know, thinking of bell to bell, from the time the student gets to school to the time they leave the school, the cognitive, the social, the emotional, the communication, physical, sensory, and just having that kind of think through of where that impact is. And it's not just always academic. And you know, as you were talking, it just that burnout is real for families, especially families that have kiddos with medical needs. And what advice do you have for that in terms of managing the burnout? And then also, this is probably going to add to the burnout, is just really advice for bridging that communication piece, because in working with the medical field and the educational world, it's really two silos. And how can we help our parents that do feel the burnout because they're navigating all these extra appointments and the medical, PT, OT, speech, doctors, chemo, whatever that may be, and then still trying to have a conversation with the school so that they feel informed? And how do we even know like what to say? And I asked you about 12 questions in 30 seconds.
Oh, but you brought up an image though that I think our listeners will appreciate, which is silos. And I think that that's important to remember, is that oftentimes there's so much that as a parent, especially of a parent of a child who maybe has an IEP or a 504 plan and has these additional medical needs and is seeing multiple specialists, that you've probably experienced where you as a parent know what's going on. And perhaps you've verbally told lots of people important in your child's life, like their teacher or the principal, or you mentioned it to somebody important at the school. And therefore, in your mind, that communication happened. And it did. That's what I want to say. It did, and it's important, but it happened within siloed systems. And that's the really super frustrating part. So I just want to recognize that, that as a parent, you are indeed navigating siloed systems. So the school being one silo, that IEP or 504 team being one silo, our medical system being another silo. And that one of the most frustrating things that I think I've, you know, worked with families in navigating is the just deluge of paperwork to even get those systems to agree to talk to each other is absolutely ridiculous. So we can recognize that and just say it's ridiculous, and that some systems are slightly better than others, but some are still stuck in the 80s and are asking for faxed permission, right? Back and forth. I still had somebody in my office sending out a fax to a school the other day, and I was like, they have a fax? What? Where did, I want to see it, because I haven't seen one in a while, but they still exist. So do some insurance companies. So there's a lot of things that even as a parent, if you've given verbal permission, right, and you may have said, you can talk to the OT, you can talk to the speech, you can do this, you can do that, that sometimes those siloed systems do require you to sign something. And so I think that is also empowering information to know, to ask, to say, do you need me to sign something to memorialize this, that you can access this information, or that this information can be shared with you? Because that's so frustrating to have your child attending speech or OT or PT sessions outside of the school and perhaps concurrently within the school when those two systems aren't talking to each other, because you know that as a parent, they can work together much more powerfully when they each know what the other is doing. So I think just recognizing that they are siloed systems, and it does require a parent to usually give permission in writing in some way for some of that information to be shared, or for the parent to take on the role of sometimes communicating that information. The one thing I will say is also really helpful is also usually asking and leveraging things like insurance-based care coordinators or nursing care coordinators to take over some of that paperwork burden, to just help facilitate some of that information flow among people. That can be helpful. Not always the be-all, end-all, but it's one additional way. But I think that it's a huge burden placed on families, and that some of the families that I've seen are most kind of helpful or efficient at that also keep kind of a running tab or a running list of the who's who and the what's what, right? Like, what's the name? What's the email? What's the phone number? What's the contact? So that those folks can get releases and exchange information a little bit more quickly. But that is what I would say also an executive functioning burden. And we know that when you're facing burnout or exhaustion, our executive functioning skills do not work as well. And so it is okay to recognize that you may need help or support in that as a parent, or that it may take a little bit longer.
What have you seen that has worked in terms of like, you're like, wow, this team here is working really well together?
Like school, family, medical teams where does coming together. What I really see about effective teams that I appreciate working with, or those on their way to becoming really effective teams, is designated kind of point persons for communication and people who take that role seriously and actually do it so that the burden is not all on the parent, right? And so that when I see a school team designate, you know, that this person, whether it's the 504 chair, the IEP chair, the school counselor, will be the kind of designated point of contact to reach out to some of these outside professionals, have that phone call, and then communicate back to their people that need to, so that it doesn't just stay within that person, but that relevant information gets communicated. Similarly, also within medical care systems where that happens, because what I've seen it be really ineffective is when someone say, well, I've called that doctor 5 times and then, you know, I wasn't able to get through or they didn't answer or things like that. And so on the medical side is when there is actually effective administrative communication systems, so that simple things like access to, you know, when's Johnny's next appointment coming up can be communicated back so that a school can plan to share that information with a developmental pediatrician or the most up-to-date plan, or to say, we need the seizure emergency care plan signed off on by such and such date. Please make sure you get this to it. So when each kind of point of the silo has a go-to person, and that's reliable and the information flows back to it, as opposed to, we all know that that psych concept of that diffusion of responsibility happens. Oh, I told somebody at the school, but they didn't know that they then had to communicate that information back to others. I think that puts parents in a really bad spot, because then they're the ones constantly having to do all of the communication. So it can seem like a little thing as a parent to be like, so who's going to be responsible for reaching out now that I've signed this release? Like, what are you going to do with this? I think is a really okay and empowering thing to ask, so that you're not giving permission to share information in vain.
Yeah, absolutely. And always asking, you know, what does this look like in real life? What does this look like for me? What does this look like for my child? I think those are absolutely empowering questions for our families to ask. And then even to kind of build upon that, right? And you mentioned if there is a medical need and we need a seizure plan or we need another type of care plan, thinking through what that looks like from the nurse's perspective at the school, and then asking, you know, what is the nurse's role in terms of carrying out this plan, communicating to us, communicating us meaning say the parent or us meaning the school, or what is that role, and taking the time to kind of build that landscape before school really gets underway, or if school is underway, but really building that landscape of understanding. Mm-hmm. And then I always would encourage parents to also ask their school, what happens if the nurse isn't there? What happens if there is, right? If during, you know, specials or recess or any of those things, or if the teacher isn't there or out or at training or sick or whatever, so that as a parent, you feel comfortable knowing that, as we all know, somebody, you know, we're all going to get sick at some point. We need to take a personal day, whatever that may be. It may be a training. There's going to be somebody that may not know your baby as well as they should, and what do we put in place for that?
100%. I love the plan B idea, because I think that's also where teams can get strongest. And I think the other part that you raise in that is that for me, I frame it, and I hope I leave parents feeling empowered to frame some of these things, as that it's not disagreement, but it's actually truly making a team stronger by facing concerns together. And that builds really healthy teams and communications when we can unite around confronting shared difficulties or shared challenge and say, you know, what's going to be going on for my child when the worst does happen, when the 3 people that know my child the best are out sick or at a training, or, and there's a fire drill, what are we going to do now? And that when we can unite around that shared challenge, then everyone's actually going to feel really comfortable and have a purpose. I always joke too, that we need people on our teams to feel like they have a purpose, that they have a job. And that when we can unite people around that, everyone feels really good about that, that they're contributing.
Yeah, absolutely. And they everybody feels seen, everybody feels heard, yeah. And we're truly working. So when you offer recommendations for a parent, for a school, sometimes families may try some of these strategies or supports at home first, right? But maybe they aren't sure if they're kind of making a difference. What are some signs that parents can look for to say, all right, this support is working, it's not working, how do we move to the next?
I call it the rose-colored glasses too. I don't know if you've ever seen this, that especially if we have high hopes for a particular behavioral intervention, medication, strategy, schedule change, something that we're doing different as a family to help our child make life a little bit easier. When we have those high hopes on it, we all put on the rose-colored glasses. And I call this like, we also have to be sure that we're guarding against a placebo effect, because especially when you have a child and you've got a great and effective team, that's actually a danger. Is that we might be seeing and saying, wow, I put in this, minor change and oh my gosh, everything's great now. And then what happens, right? The psychology principle at play is that, if we strongly believe that an effect is going to happen, we are heightened to look for that positive change. When we're heightened to look for that positive change, we notice it more, we praise it more, we attend to it more, just like how if we are trying to eat more healthfully and reduce the amount we intake, if we do a food journal, we eat less, not surprisingly, because we're attending to what we eat. So same thing goes, and I call it just being teaching our families about the placebo effect. And so I think the best way to guard against that is being able to ground things in some objective data wherever you can, to be able to say, what is the measurable thing that I can't have rose-colored glasses on about and that I'll be able to hang my hat on? Or, and this is something I will say I got from a developmental and behavioral pediatrician I worked with a while ago, where he would have, when he was starting families on a new prescription medication for ADHD, I don't prescribe medications, but he did. And he would, have families do a 1 week on, 1 week off, and not tell teacher which was which, and do, some rating scales, some Vanderbilts, and child would, take a sugar pill or take a Nerd or something on that second week, because they really wanted to see, when we told people we're trying something different, we're trying a new medication, they actually wanted to see. So they wanted that data. And, he would look and see week one should look different from week two. And if they don't, then what I prescribed isn't doing any good. And so I think that my take home from that is, whatever we can we ground it in some data so that we know if I have baseline five refusals a week from this particular math task, and I do this mild behavioral change or intervention or medication or whatever it is that five going to go down to three or two, or is it not? And then can I also switch it so that I'm not doing that on a different week and be able to run my own mini controlled experiment on that? So I love having some data, because if a placebo works, I am not going to knock it, right? Like if all of your child needs is a jelly bean and, a reminder that this is going to help them, let's all do a jelly bean in the morning. If that's the ritual that gets your day off to a great start, I am not going to knock it, because the placebo effect is also really real.
That is, yeah, I like that, right? Because so at what point are we bringing kids into the conversation, right? So however a kiddo communicates, talking, saying, technology device, hands, however they're doing it, how can parents make sure that their kiddo's voice becomes part of the plan?
Yeah. So one thing, I don't know, Wendy, if you like this idea, so I'm also curious about this, is I think also having, even when they're younger, making sure that we include like a picture of them in our discussion. Yeah. So that we remember and have kind of that, because vision, picture's worth a thousand words, but it also cues us in our visual memory, because sometimes when we're talking about effective teams, not everyone around the table may have as much experience as you as the parent does. I particularly say that for my parents who've had experiences with their children where the medical needs of the child may not be apparent to the team. Say, for example, some of our children that I work with where they're born extremely premature, and maybe doing fantastic in so many ways, but the parent sees, this was my baby in an incubator and that had a whole bunch of tubes and everything else. And you all may not have seen that. And sometimes that's actually helpful to bring in that picture so that people know kind of where you've been to where you are now. And so that they also know that's the experience that you've had. So I think when they're really young, pictures are really helpful. And then also, I think it's very helpful to think about what's the problem we're trying to solve and how is it best for this particular child to communicate. Some teens are fantastic about memorializing their thoughts into writing or into an interview with a parent or a counselor that can be brought back to the teen if they're not really great about communicating. And then I think there's also the part about making sure that child participation or teen participation doesn't get accidentally weaponized. Because I know I've seen that sometimes and I worry about that, especially some of our tweens and teens that may be real wanting to please the adults in their lives, where we have to be very mindful that we're not asking them leading questions about, you know, I noticed you don't like it when you get pulled out into that small group for tests. Do you want us to stop doing that? Is much different from saying, what's your experience of taking tests under these accommodation conditions? Should we try it in a different way? What do you think? Right? Those are very different ways of kind of framing conversations. And so I think as parents, you're probably the best ones to know. And also to make sure that anytime we're talking about that transition to adulthood planning, that it's super important that we're involving our teens in those discussions, because it is going to be them in adulthood when they talk about what they want to be doing after they exit that IEP or after they exit that. And what they may have provided to a school counselor on one random day in January may be different in 3 months. And so it's really important, you know, they move fast. And so we sometimes have to keep up with them. So having their involvement, even if it's brief and mindful, I think can be really helpful.
So how do we then connect the dots, right? So if we have the voice of our kiddo, we have the voice of our specialist, we have the voice of the school. And if as a parent, I'm, you know, doing community data collection, so to say, in home, and school's doing theirs and doctors have the results, how can we kind of connect all of these dots to tell one story about our beautiful baby? And I say baby can be anywhere from baby to taller than I am.
Yeah, actually, I think that's also where I've sometimes talked with families about what do they want to craft it into an intro letter, particularly for our, you know, we know that we have an area where we have lots of families who move from place to place, and whether they're military or relocating or State Department or other things like that, maybe having to reintroduce their child to a new team at different points in time. And so I do think it's actually a kind of an introduction letter. Sometimes it's helpful to give a little bit about who is this child? What developmental stage are they at now? Where have they come? And then also, what's the important things that this team needs to know? And maybe it is to literally point them to and say, this child has fantastic physical therapy progress. You really need to see the notes of their most recent PT to have an idea of how far they've come and why independence is so important for, you know, just as an example. Or you need to understand that these learning progress has been really hard fought. Please see their most recent neuropsych. I think that can be really helpful to give people an idea to point them into the direction. I really detest it sometimes when I hear teams or families get talked into saying that they have a complicated kid, because I worry that that label sometimes intimidates teams, and it shouldn't. It really should be like a welcoming and an introduction of, yeah, we're all complicated. But that we can understand each other, and that there are key and important things to understand, which is also why, again, getting back to my, like, I apologize on behalf of my field, because unapproachable, really lengthy reports are going to turn people off. And that's not what we want to do. We want to invite in and make sure that it's possible for team members to feel like they have the understanding and that they have the skills to be able to work successfully to help your child get on that better trajectory.
I think it's even important to do that, you know, kind of introductory letter, so to say, not necessarily even to new teams, but year to year, right? Because you could have parts of a new team or a new teacher or a new therapist, and then developing that as a reintroduction, because also growth happens in the summer. Again, if you're going to thinking through as an introduction to a new school, and really kind of making sure that that student and their needs are the top of mind for all that are supporting that student.
Yeah. And prioritize. I know that you talked about that earlier, and I'm big in agreement of that, is that we sometimes can't tackle everything all at once, but when we can highlight for people, these are the key priorities and areas of growth that we're really looking forward to see for this particular child in the next year, or these are the real opportunities where we've been stuck. previously, and we're hoping to get unstuck to help move forward in the next year. I think that's really important to think about.
So if we have this team, right, of folks, and what happens if, as a parent, I'm hearing different advice from different professionals, right? And that can happen. So what can we do to really kind of think through these recommendations when they don't match up? And then how do we decide what to prioritize?
Well, I'm so glad you asked this question, because I think this is a real life and so relatable experience of absolutely anyone who's ever had to see their generalist, see some specialists, hear educations, and then anyone who ever has in-laws weigh in with their opinions about anything, right? Like, this is a pretty universal human experience that as many concerns that you may have about a child, you can go and get five extremely disparate and differing opinions all offered to you with complete and 100% veracity of their opinion, where someone is just saying, I know 100% if you just ignore this behavior, it would go away. I know 100% if you did this, this would go away. I know 100% if you gave them this supplement that's magical, it would go away, right? Like, and that can be absolutely maddening. So I would say, as a neuropsychologist, from my perspective, the one thing that I think is a hack that parents need to keep in mind about human nature is that we're flawed decision makers. And this is human. And so this is when I normally have a conversation with a parent and say, so I know you've gotten different advice from different people. Here's the thing to know about how we make decisions as humans. We're not always great at it. Just we aren't. Like, that's how we're built. We are really wired for connection. And so we tend to take advice and perspective from the people who actually make us feel the best, right? This is why when we think about, you know, when you think about your doctors, when you think about choosing your doctors and your specialists, or even deciding who do you think was, you know, your favorite teacher for your child, human nature is we usually list off the people that we like the most and that made us feel good, the most warm, fuzzy, or the best bedside manner people. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's not a great correlation between that skill set, technical knowledge, and really great advice, right? And this is where I've had some parents come and tell me, yeah, like this, you know, neurologist or behaviorist or psychologist or something, they were not warm, fuzzy, and I didn't like them. But 10 years later, I realized that they were spot on with their advice or their recommendations or something like that. And I wish I had listened. And so that's the human nature hack of knowledge. I cannot prevent it. It's like how we're wired. But as parents, I want to like take that piece of knowledge and say, here it is my little gift to you. Keep that in mind, that sometimes the people that make us feel the most comfortable are going to be the ones that we're going to trust. But when it comes to our babies, the people that are counting on us to make really good decisions and sort through the woo-woo advice from the solid advice, from the scary advice, that we need to recognize and be able to then critically evaluate, okay, of all of this advice that we're getting, or these different perspectives, who am I getting it from who has experience with the types of things that my child might have? Who am I getting it from that is someone I can count on and trust, which is also important. And then also, you know, either expertise, experience, actual knowledge. And I think it is very fair for parents to be able to ask and to say, so what have you seen as this outcome? What would you predict, right? To be able to ask some of those follow-up questions. And if you find it all you're getting discomfort from people and asking about that, maybe that's a sign that that advice isn't as solid as it was presented at. And sometimes that is, right? Where people say, well, this is my gut. This is what I've seen clinically. Do you have anything objective you can help me back that up? Because it would help us all to sleep a little bit better at night. And that's when I will also say that when we realize that sometimes people make decisions based on what I would call clinical lore or kind of widely accepted things in our fields that then turn out to be wrong, right? And so I can think about, and I know educators will talk about this, where there's trends in education. Same with trends in psychology, same with trends in speech and language and in OT. There's certain trends and fields that kind of come and go, but when they're not widely supported or hold the test of time, that's where parents then are the ones that have to say, well, tell me the latest and greatest. And also, has this changed over time? And I know I've sometimes had conversations and told families, well, you know, I would have told you 5 years ago this, but now my advice is this based on this evidence. And so I think it's also important to evaluate whether or not evidence does change over time, because it might. And that that's okay. And you also want to be able to seek out the stuff that maybe there's some outdated advice or opinions out there, and then that's evolved and that's okay. But sometimes people are giving you old advice, unfortunately.
And it's important to have those conversations and have those clarifying questions, because again, as a parent, you know, it can be very overwhelming and you have this fear and love. I would say you don't have to do it all in one day.
Yeah.
And, you know, take little tiny steps as best as you can and seek out folks that are going to kind of help you see the forest for the trees and a lot of this. And even, you know, and what you're saying really kind of aligns with what I tell parents as well in terms of that parent input statement for an IEP. Think about setting the stage of your kiddo strengths, pockets of vulnerability, what they do really well, and how can we leverage those really phenomenal skills to support maybe some of the lagging skills. And to think about, you know, where do you see your kiddo in a couple months, a year, a couple years, so that you really have that clarity to start to, all right, how far did we get? Did things change? How do we need to change? What do we need to do? And kind of building that team around your kiddo for the support and taking all of the information that is given so that we can then, you know, back to the kind of that connecting of the dots, build an IEP with goals that really do help a kid access future education, employment, and independence.
Oh, that's where it's at.
Yeah, right? Right?
It means nothing if we don't think towards the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we're kind of winding down, what is something I did not know enough about that I should have asked that I didn't ask?
Oh, one thing I think that's on my mind sometimes is also knowing when you need to walk away.
Yes. Let's talk about it.
Let's talk about it, because I think another thing that I see sometimes is that it is okay to recognize that some of these challenges or discussions can be ones where you actually just need to walk away and take a breath. And that's one thing that I think I appreciate about human decision-making in my work. I can see it happen in my office with teens when I see that, you know, they've been pushed and then they're just not able to make good decisions anymore. And that even as adults, that can happen to us with fully developed brains, is that when we are under stress and duress, to realize it is okay to take a break about making a decision about something, because just to, again, that, you know, gift about little human cognition that we have is that none of us make good decisions under stress, and to take time about making those decisions is okay. Even if you don't do anything different, even if you go with your initial decision, I think sometimes also making sure that if you recognize, ooh, no, getting into a situation where maybe I shouldn't be making decisions at this moment in time is okay. And if you need that permission, I will write it for you.
So what is one way that a parent knows that they're really on the right track for successful advocacy, bridging their health findings into that school advocacy, again, that word, what is one way that they would know that they're on the right track?
Ooh, when you find that the team is not surprised. And I can give two key examples of that, because I think this is where you realize I've signed forms and I've had this and I've communicated this information. And the best example I can give was of a child that I worked with who was wearing hearing aids. Then I walked in and did a school-based observation, and the child was like not tuning in, really struggling in some ways. And the teacher had zero idea that the child wore hearing aids. And this was a parent who was a fantastic advocate and who had given, you know, permission for all of this information to be shared. But this teen, you know, was taking the hearing aids off and putting them in their pocket. And they don't tend to work too well from your pocket. Like, Bluetooth is really cool. It just doesn't quite work that well. And so I think, you know, you're on the right path when there's limited surprises because it was a situation where I, you know, told the teacher, like, did you know that she's got hearing aids? And the teacher was just shocked and would have done different things had they known. But when you realize that you're telling people information that they already know, that is your positive feedback for you've done a fantastic job of bridging that gap. When people are like, yeah, I know that. Good. I'm so glad you know that. Because when there's no surprises, we are all working well together. Then we can work together as a well-oiled machine.
If you had a billboard for parents with one tip, what would it be and why?
Oh, you're right. Actually, sorry. Well, my positive reinforcement to parents, because nobody tells parents that enough. And that I think as parents, there's a lot of like second guessing of our decisions and the things that we've done and everything else. And I just want to be like, no, actually, most of the time you're right. And also that it's okay. It is actually going to be okay.
Such a pleasure. And Dr. Reisman, I really appreciate your time. Where can folks find you?
Oh, so folks can find me at the Chesapeake Center for ADHD Learning and Behavioral Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And I think we'll drop a link in the show notes for that. And you'll also see me around town walking with my really cute little dog with short legs, long body, and a curly tail.
And what is that puppy's dog's name?
His name is Aries. He actually was in the Montgomery County Fair this year. He was pretty, with my daughter. She showed him.
That's the best part about the fair.
The fair is the best. And the food. But, there's that.
Oh, absolutely. Hands down. You have to get all the food when you're there. But when my kids were little, I would make them go see all the events and, you know, the biggest ball of whatever and all of that good stuff before we went on the rides.
Gotta see the animals and the display. Yes.
We gotta see all that first. Well, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. And I can't wait for people to listen to this several times and get all this information. So thank you.
Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you for joining me today. The conversation with Dr. Reisman was very powerful. It was a reminder that you don't have to be a doctor or a lawyer to help your kiddo succeed. You just need the right questions, the right tools, and the courage to keep showing up for your kiddo. One little tip for the week to help get you going. When you receive a medical or neuropsych report, don't try to tackle it all at once. I think that was the thread of what we were talking about here today. Start small. Read just one section, like the recommendations. Highlight one item you'd like to see in action at home or at the school. Remember, advocacy is certainly a marathon. It is not a sprint. One step at a time is going to get you there. If today's episode gave you some encouragement, please take a moment to like, share, and follow the Special Ed Strategist podcast so more parents can feel supported in their journey. And remember, you don't have to navigate this path alone. I'm Wendy Taylor, your host, IEP coach, certified educational therapist, and executive director of Learning Essentials. I'm here to walk alongside you as you advocate for your kiddo. Until next time, keep believing in your child's potential and in your own power as their strongest advocate. Bye for now.